Now, detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The crash of a small airplane off the Hawaiian Islands in late 2013 may be the key through which we can understand the nature of the deep state's attempts to control our lives. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. We thank you for listening at VFTB.net. If you're watching this on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, make sure you follow along closely because we'll have some graphics to accompany this conversation, which will help explain the opening statement today. Our guests have been investigating this crash I referenced and do so with some expertise. First, we'll bring in a gentleman who's got nearly three decades experience in the aviation industry, both as a flight instructor and as a former CEO and president of several companies involved in the aviation industry. And he is the co-author of the book that is the subject of our conversation today, the book called The Fuddy Hoax, co-authored with Nelly Ristvet. We welcome Hugo Fugen to the program for the first time. Hugo, good to talk with you again.
Good morning.
And accompanying him, a gentleman who has some insight in the event that took place on December 11th of 2013, the crash of this small plane that carried the woman whose name is on the title of the book, Loretta Fuddy. We will call him W. W, we appreciate you taking time out of your schedule this morning.
Of course. Glad to be here.
Hugo, we'll open with you. You make an interesting comment. And the website, by the way, for the book, I'll point out right at the front here, is thefuddyhoax.com. That's T-H-E-F-U-D-D-Y-H-O-A-X, thefuddyhoax.com. I guess a couple of questions just to open it from a broad perspective. Who was Loretta Fuddy, and why do you call the crash of the plane in which we are told she lost her life, why do you call it the Rosetta Stone for deep state hoaxes?
Yeah, those are interesting questions. Thank you. Loretta Fuddy was, for a brief time, probably about 3 years, the director of the Hawaii Department of Health. And she was appointed to that position in a very unique way, where Governor Abercrombie at the time held a press conference and basically announced that the current director was resigning, and he didn't even know why he was resigning. And the governor replaced this guy named Neil Palafox with Fuddy in just an instant. She came out of nowhere, didn't have the kind of credentials that one usually has in that position. She had no medical degree, as the previous occupants of that did. But she did have other experience, and she was the, North American chairman of an organization called Sabud, which back in the 60s in Indonesia was criticized by the then president of Indonesia, Sukarno, as being a CIA front. And that does suggest some background for Loretta Fuddy and her association with that organization, and particularly as she rose to great heights mm-hmm. in that organization. And we'll note that that organization has, among others, offices in Hawaii, in Seattle, in Langley, Virginia, just by coincidence.
Really?
So Loretta Fuddy was just newly into this position and just as quickly exited that position 3 years later. Now, she was one.
And by the way, Hugo, there's only about 3,000 members in this organization in the whole world. So it's not like it's some huge organization. It's a very fringe operation. It's very small. If there's even 3,000 members in the organization, that even is probably cooking the books. So it's not some monstrous organization. The likelihood of somebody who was actually connected to Obama's mother and Obama himself early in their life, suddenly becoming the director of public health is very, very remote.
Yeah.
This isn't like, you know, Baptists all over the world, and so the guy's a Baptist. No, this is a very, very fringe organization
And
that probably is very demonstrably connected to CIA. So anyway.
So another religious group. And just to interject here, not to derail the conversation early on, but this is really interesting to me. I've interviewed Peter Lavenda several times. He's a researcher and into the occult, and he points out that there are certain ostensibly Christian organizations that seem to appear at strange points in American history, like the Kennedy assassination, guys who like David Ferry and Jack Martin in New Orleans, who were wandering bishops, so-called wandering bishops of something called the American Orthodox Catholic Church, which had no connection to Roman Catholicism. But, you know, suddenly you have these guys who Lavenda refers to as wandering bishops, who show up at strange events that are clearly intelligence operations. So this Sabud, which is, as I understand it, an acronym for three Javanese words, ostensibly a religious organization.
With
an office that just happens to be in Langley, Virginia, which is where CIA headquarters are located.
Yeah, well, it's I think a mile apart, but anyway, it's close. And this Stanley Ann Dunham, who is ostensibly Barack Obama's mother, was also associated with that group during her time in Indonesia. You might recall they lived there for a while.
Right, right. How coincidental.
Stanley Ann Dunham married an Indonesian guy who had studied at the East-West Institute in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Who was coincidentally closely related to the military in his involvement.
Hmm.
And by the way, some of the only pictures that we have of Obama in his early youth are of him playing guitar at Sabud events and participating in Sabud events as a a preteen. So to put this in context, this very, very tiny organization on the whole planet, one of their, if not, you know, senior U.S. member, suddenly becomes the person who is fielding the hits, the problems with the birth certificate in Hawaii. It's a stretch to say that this just happened to occur as part of a plan.
Yeah. Wow. Hmm.
And she was involved with Barack Obama's long-form birth certificate and a number of other documents that kind of supported that, a verification by the state of Arizona Secretary of State, for example. And these things we have some reason to believe were false, that as many document experts have looked at them and almost universally people are saying those were false. That's certainly verified by Joe Arpaio, Arizona sheriff, very famous repute, and this cold case posse, which was working on that question for several years, I think 5 years or so before Joe was elected out of office or unelected from that office.
Right.
But they too came up with experts who were able to say that certainly a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And we concur with that and think there are other reasons to think so as well. But Loretta Fuddy was in on that from the word go, and she was the one who had oversight over the department and probably would have had the ability to pull strings if that were necessary. And the strings and breadcrumbs that we see in those false documents lead us to believe that was her fingerprint involved. Now, she was ostensibly the mayor of a leper community that was managed by the Hawaii Department of Health, and that's on the northern side of Molokai, which is a peninsula, 5-square-mile area, that has this secluded place, a town, if you will, Kalopapa, that no one else could get to or can get to without a permit. You cannot go to that place except by mule or airplane. or boat, but generally not. In any event, you need a permit, and no one without a permit gets there. So that's true even today, even though the leper community is rather small compared to what it was years ago. I believe it was founded in 1866 or something like that. So it's been around for 150 years or so. But anyway, as the president of that, she had, or the, sorry, mayor of Kalaupapa, she had duties occasionally. And on an occasion of her being there after she was leaving from those duties via airplane, this crash happened. And it's very unique. There were an airplane with eight paying passengers and a pilot. And very shortly after it took off, the pilot said he experienced, or the airplane experienced, a catastrophic engine failure, and the engine stopped. And he had to put it down in the water because it couldn't reach land again. Now, we've looked at those data that surround that and see that there's almost everything the pilot has said is not true. And the passengers, coincidentally, go right along with that. But let me just close out your question with regard to Loretta Fuddy.
Mm-hmm.
She, we understand and have the proof for, exited that situation without any severe effects. She certainly didn't die as she was claimed to have. So that's a very important difference. That is, she was doing Barack Obama all these favors by falsifying documents. And, of course, she's able then to live a life after this event, probably with her feet in the sand and watching sunsets. And coincidentally, her family was able to resolve a couple of lawsuits where they benefited tremendously. We don't have an official number, but we can be assured it was in the millions of dollars. That the manufacturer of the engine that supposedly failed in this event paid them. So all this is well orchestrated so that there's basically a reward for doing favors for Barack Obama.
Letting things drop.
So that's who Loretta Fuddy is, I would say. But the Rosetta Stone for this event, this being a Rosetta Stone for other things, is because of its multi-agency nature. That is, we have in this event not simply a little commuter airline doing something, but we have the FAA is covering for this, the NTSB, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Coast Guard, Hawaii county governments in Hawaii. And there's all kinds of coordination with these groups and agencies that show us what kind of corruption is deeply seated in these organizations. And people are able to keep quiet such that the citizenry of the United States doesn't hear about that. So watching how that well-oiled machine can work and these people coordinate with each other is hugely important to understand how the deep state has control over these kinds of events and can make wizardry appear as just a normal event or an accident, a pure accident that requires a manufacturer of the engine to pay out money to people.
Let me just chime in here a little bit too, guys. In context, the election was still, a year plus off, and Loretta Fuddy had done her business with the birth certificate, then continued on as the director. Once she'd kind of put things in play, got the birth certificate in play, she was idling along in her job. There were some lawsuits and inquiries. There was the potential for some difficulty. But more importantly, it was mission accomplished in most of what she could or would really need or be able to do. And so she needed to be extricated in part, just by her age. She wanted to go have a life and probably didn't want to be director of public health forever. And then she was the potential liability. She's hanging there. If any of these things did get traction, it might look more nefarious at some point for her to have a problem if any of these things actually started to get some traction. So mm-hmm. it was mission accomplished. It was time to pull her out. And this event conveniently did just that. And, you know, you don't have a person to go after to interview.
Right.
So that's kind of – and the other thing is, remember, what actually caused the birth certificate to reemerge at the time that she came on the scene? It was Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Trump at the time was – questioning the birth certificate. Remember, around the country, we had these billboards that were beginning to get a lot of momentum on main highways around the country. Where's the birth certificate?
Right, right.
And so it was, it had the potential to gain a lot of momentum. It was just starting to get momentum. So when Loretta Fuddy came on the scene, and also the governor of Hawaii, had famously claimed to be friends with the family and things like that, and then was going to get to the bottom of this. And there had been a couple interviews where suddenly, gee, we looked everywhere. We can't find it. We can't find this birth certificate. And so she came in a moment of crisis. The existing director of public health was forced out, probably under some duress, threats to his financial well-being with his own practice and medical group, with some billing improprieties to Medicare, Medicaid, or some silly thing. And so he bows out. She's immediately put in play and comes in to fix the situation and solve these problems, does the job, stays in the job till, you know, they know that it's mission accomplished. There's nothing more she can do. And mm-hmm. then suddenly she's extracted from the situation by this death in a place that's extremely remote, where the Department of Public Health controls the environment. And you can't even go in there to look or have bystanders seeing something happen, because they control that area completely. It might as well be in Antarctica or Mars.
Hmm.
It's that remote and isolated and sealed off from the public.
Well, just to give give a timeline.
Anyway, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I'm that's,
okay. I just to recap very quickly the timeline of what's going on here. Loretta Fuddy was named the acting director of the Hawaii Department of Health in January of 2011. That was confirmed. She was appointed the new director in March of 2011. You mentioned Where's the Birth Certificate. That was actually the title of Jerome Corsi's book, which was published that spring, 2011. So this was all leading up to the 2012 election, and the questions are being raised by Mr. Trump, by Jerome Corsi. Of course, that was publicized by WND.com, which is a very popular news site, especially with conservatives. Loretta Fuddy put into position. The crisis is averted. Obama is reelected. Fuddy, who was 65 years old at the time for death in December of 2013, one might think that, because this has been a pattern you've seen in the past with people who participated in some event that they regret, perhaps get to a point in their lives when they think, I've got nothing left to lose, so I might as well come clean and tell the truth and get this off my conscience. But before, and we have no idea of knowing whether that was in her mind or heart at all, but certainly her untimely death eliminated that possibility as far as the deep state was concerned. Now, Hugo, you mentioned that she survived the crash itself. So her death took place sometime.
That's the official story.
Okay, so she died sometime after the plane.
Let me add this. She was a dyed in the wool. She was not going to,
okay,
regret what she was doing. She was a true believer. Is a true believer. If she's still out there somewhere, she's sworn in blood oath. She wasn't gonna change. She was a very key component in this. And I will add to one thing we don't often hear, but the co-author on the book, Nellie Rustfeldt, a lot of the work that actually was, you know, helped us to get to the bottom of this whole birth certificate thing, that came from Nellie.
Hmm.
Long before the crash and event, she was one of the people helping ferret out some of this information because of her background in records and records keeping. She had been doing blog work in trying to expose these improprieties with what was going on with the birth certificate prior to Loretta Fetty's alleged death. So she, we hear the other names with Arpaio and other people who had done work. Nellie was kind of unsung. She went by the internet name Butter Dazillion, and which was just kind of an inside fun thing amongst friends for the name she chose there. But she was really very key and under threat because of it in what she was doing to expose the improprieties in this birth certificate. And that needs to be acknowledged and recognized within our investigative community, because she was not a bit part player. She was a significant mainstream player in helping us to understand the magnitude of the lie that was being foisted on the public.
And I should point out that Doug Hagman of the Hagman Report, in the interviews that he conducted with Hugo in the past, was highly complimentary of the investigative work that went into all that and the crash. To the point where Doug said he would be willing to take the information at any court in the land and present it, enter it into evidence. It is that meticulously researched. So I am coming late to the party, I will admit, on talking with you gentlemen about this, both of the Hagmans and John B. Wells on his Caravan at Midnight program talked about this back in January. So this isn't sad to say, we're not breaking news here, but I'm glad that we can take some time to try to bring this to the attention of the public. Hugo, okay, go ahead.
If I may, there's two little things. One is it might have gone a little differently if back in 2011 Donald Trump had gotten even more traction than he had, because that was about the time that people were beginning to say, well, you know, could we consider this guy for president? And it was just about that time, as you might have noted, April 27th of 2011, that Barack Obama on television with great fanfare introduced to Savannah Guthrie and others his long-form birth certificate. And that seemed to take the wind out of Donald Trump's sails a little bit. He no longer made the claims as he did as strongly, even though the question of whether he might eventually be a presidential candidate continued. They did not kind of have the ramp up that they were having back in early 2011. But also concomitant with that, in April of 2011, just after, that is 4 or 5 days after, as the birth certificate that was being presented was being roundly panned as being false, and people were showing all kinds of problems like layers and fraudulent this and, mm-hmm. and strange that, African and blah, blah, blah. All of that was growing as a grassroots groundswell of complaint that there has to be something wrong with this. Well, 5 days later, guess what happens? Do you remember? The Osama bin Laden card gets played.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
And all of this is wiped off the map. I mean, all the news reports, no time for any birth certificate discussion. And that Osama bin Laden card could have been played any time. You might recall there was discussion Barack had turned that down 4 or 5 times or something before that.
Right, right.
And just at that time. Now, why even mention that? Well, of course, for the news cycle thing, but there's a commonality here as well, that we believe the U.S. Navy SEALs were used in both of these situations. to actually propagandize the public.
Wow.
In the case of Osama bin Laden and in the case of getting rid of Loretta Fuddy.
Hmm.
And they, that was
well,
a commonality.
Let me just clarify this slightly. The SEAL team assets, at the very least, were in play in the Loretta Fuddy crash. Let me add this, too, because we won't have time in this interview to go into it. But Hugo did actually two long interviews on John Wells' show, and I believe those are available on the Internet if
yes.
you look for Hugo and John Wells. And so for those that want a blow-by-blow detailed description of what occurred, that's also available there. And, I mean, that's like 5.5 hours.
Right.
Yeah, first time John had ever done two back-to-back interviews with the same guest. And I only say that because we're trying to give your listeners a thumbnail sketch of what was in play. But if they want to actually understand this, and remember, this is about the president of the United States,
right.
the most powerful person, arguably on the planet, at least from a political side,
mm-hmm.
and a huge scam was conducted, not just against the American people, but the people of the whole world, in order to keep this person in power at a critical moment. And what was it that he had to accomplish that those puppet masters behind the scenes had to have this guy in office to accomplish during this period from, you know, let's say 2011 to the end of his presidency?
Yeah.
What occurred there? Something that I have personally discussed pretty extensively on the airwaves, which is Benghazi and the aftermath. What was Benghazi about? Benghazi was about the reshaping of the Mideast
right.
by covert action,
mm-hmm.
working in conjunction with the Muslim Brotherhood in order to change the governments in Egypt and Syria,
right.
Libya, Tunisia, etc. This was about moving guns. This was a gun-running operation up to Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan.
Absolutely.
In order to go after Assad. And this player, this person, was pivotal in making sure that that happened. The powers behind this president had to have him there to complete this task and to get us into arguably this next conflict that we're close to now that could very well eventually, I would believe, end up in World War III. You know, is it a military-industrial thing? Well, military assets were used. So I come back to, is this SEAL team members actively participating in this? At the very least, military assets were used and in play in this fraudulent hoax of a death, plane crash with Loretta Fuddy. Were SEAL team members directly the persons involved in the water in this? It may have been contractors. It probably was contractors. It probably was not active SEAL team members, but certainly could have been because included in this, hey, there's a submarine that's assigned to the SEALs out of Hawaii, just so happens to be right there where the plane crash is, just a few miles offshore, exactly when this happened. There's aircraft overhead with that handle communications where the airspace has been closed for military activity directly above where this occurs at exactly this time window. Military assets were in play in order to pull off this hoax. And in my view, that's a militarization of the propaganda campaign against the American people in order to secure the results of an election to keep a person in power. It's one thing when, you know, they hire ad agencies and maybe they lie a little bit and there's a little collusion to, you know, get their guy in power. It's another thing when military assets are used in order to create, fabricate, and institute a story, protect a story, aimed at putting somebody in office politically here in the country and maintaining them in office. Mm-hmm. That is beyond any kind of, you know, thing that we can accept idly as citizens. And that raises the bar to a level that we cannot be passive or complacent about. This is a very serious breach of protocols against the American public, the American voters.
Mm. Well, let's link this together then, because I agree with your assessment on what the American government has been trying to accomplish, or rather, elites through the American government have been trying to accomplish in the Middle East for at least the last 20 years. They laid it out. In fact, General Wesley Clark very famously said that, you know, laid out sort of a roadmap that Iraq and Sudan and Syria and then Iran eventually, you know, the path to Persia, if you will, was sort of the game. And just as we record this in early November of 2017, to timestamp this for people listening to it in an archive some point in the future, we're now seeing drums of war beating between the Sunni and Shia powers in the Gulf. Saudi Arabia accusing Iran of being behind that missile that was fired at the airport in Riyadh last weekend. Hugo, should we, when we look at the Fuddy crash, the crash of this plane, and she was only one of nine passengers on board, why do you conclude with your three decades of aviation experience that the crash didn't occur the way the pilot explained it to the NTSB and the FAA?
Yes, we looked closely at the NTSB report and what all they said and did and all of the evidence related to the technical investigation of that incident. Call it a crash. I won't call it an accident. But we see that the NTSB is coming to all kinds of false conclusions. They're looking at the same evidence that is clearly one way, and they call it the other. They repeat mindlessly what the pilot has said when the evidence is provably that the pilot is lying. So we've seen that in many, 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 many instances, and mm-hmm. we can go through those as a litany if you like. But we see that again and again, that the pilot makes this or that claim. The biggest one right off the bat is he claims that there was a catastrophic engine failure in the air and the engine stopped. Well, we have, from Five Ways to Sunday, evidence running. We hear that in audio that we have that was put on ABC News, for example. Mm-hmm. And here I can play that. It was, I believe, Robin Wright on Good Morning America. And you can hear in the background as they're playing the video, we hear the engine running. Here it is.
Those passengers don't know it yet. Those passengers don't know it yet.
Did you hear in the background the engine is running?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's roughly 10 seconds after the supposed catastrophic engine failure. And yet, even though the pilot says it stopped, it's still running. Now, we don't hear a propeller sound in that, but that sound is over 15,000 RPM. That's the signature, if you will, of that engine's running. And if we listen to some of the raw audio from that, we hear, without the narration, a rise in the RPM. And then a descending RPM. So listen to this for a few seconds. Well, actually, let me set this up a bit, that there were people on board who said everything went quiet after this catastrophic engine failure. And then after a few seconds, the engine appears to start again. Well, that's not part of the official story. It never happened that way. And what we're going to hear in this particular segment is that indeed, everything seems to go quiet. All one hears is the rustling of the videographer for a few seconds, 6 seconds, and then, as if on a switch, one hears an engine running. Now, that's not the way physics works. This is an engine that takes many seconds to spool up and come to speed before it's 15,000 plus RPM. But we hear it as if it's on a switch, so we know that this audio has been doctored.
Hmm.
Here it is. What you heard there was about 6 seconds of rustling at the videographer's seat. Then, as if on a switch, the engine appears, and then it rises as RPM, and then it comes back down as RPM. So those are physically impossible. The engine cannot start that way. And furthermore, the pilot says he tried, even though he tried to make two engine restarts, they were both unsuccessful. So how he gets it apparently smoothly running such that it rises in RPM and comes back down, that's not what he said. And frankly, the way it starts is a physical impossibility, which I've verified with the pilots of this particular aircraft, the Cessna Grand Caravan. So all of these show falsification, and it's highly distressing. I mean, the NTSB, we trust to do honest investigations, and if that weren't the case, we could have all kinds of problems on the aviation safety and otherwise transportation landscape. So this is tremendously important. If the NTSB is falsifying things, oh my goodness, nothing is safe. And
yeah.
Indeed, my personal opinion would be that this manufacturer of the engine in this situation has been falsely accused, has had to pay settlements to at least two different lawsuits that were brought in Hawaii with regard to this crash.
Hmm.
But anyway, listen to this next video or audio segment where you'll hear over right after the person talks about the plane is about to crash, you'll hear a change in RPM. And that certainly sounds like a reduction in the power lever. Listen to this.
Plane is about to crash. Plane is about to crash.
Could you hear that?
Yeah,
reduction there?
The change in the pitch of the background noise, it definitely...
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. And then, so we know that's been edited, or it shows something. Here we have the moments, probably a few hundred milliseconds. Actually, there's a little longer to clip, but nonetheless, in a few hundred milliseconds, just as the aircraft is crashing into the water, the RPM changes again. And we can hear that very clearly right after it hits the water. Here's that. So, come on, guys. I thought you said the engine stopped. Well,
yeah.
That did not happen. So, and that's a smooth sound that we heard throughout, especially that earlier one. Those are smooth engine sounds. Now, if we look at the NTSB report, they said there was an intense internal fire and that several of the compressor fan blades, both the compressor and, well, it started out with the compressor fan blades, left their mooring inside the fan blade or inside the compressor and contacted the shroud and proceeded to wipe out large parts of all of the blades in both the compressor and power section of that engine. And there was a fine metallic dust that coated the blades that they examined. And they saw the melting, literally, and that all that bespeaks a severe catastrophic engine failure, just as was claimed. However, the point is they did not examine the engine that was ditched.
Oh.
We have proof of that. So,
oh. Well, let me ask very quickly.
A little bit of a twist.
Let me ask very quickly. Where did the evidence, the audio, come from? Who recorded this?
Very good. I'm glad you asked. There was a videographer on board, a person who was into free diving, who had two GoPros with him.
Okay.
Coincidentally, now they were, you know, they're both operational. We have to presume he charged the battery on them and so forth, which are good for an hour and a half. But anyway, he only provided, or we have only as a result through the NTSB, some 18 minutes or so of his video and audio, which comes in two segments. One is the pre-catastrophic engine failure, supposedly. So it essentially includes the taxi from the airport apron to the runway, the takeoff, and then some half minute or so after the takeoff, he actually claims to turn off his video. And then this, within seconds, he claims the catastrophic engine failure came as a bang that everybody heard. Everybody reported to the FAA. However, he then turns the video back on and continues rolling until his batteries ran out, says he. But that only supposedly amounted to 18 minutes worth of video. We know there are gaps in that. We can prove that as well. But anyway, that's why we have audio for this event. It comes directly from that video that was recorded by the videographer.
Interesting. And so, even more interesting that there are pieces missing.
Prove that the pilot and others were lying about their representations about what happened. And one of the big ones is, for example, what the pilot has said to the FAA. He claimed to the FAA that the accident happened at 300 feet as he was rounding the turn for Honolulu. And let me ask you, we'll tell you to pull up JPEG 32, which shows a top-down view of the crash site. And what it has is the aircraft taking off on Kalaupapa's runway 5, which is to the northeast, and it has an arrow and a tracing there, and it shows the arc where he would have turned toward Honolulu, which is essentially directly west of the Kalaupapa Airport, and that's marked on the image with a big red X.
Okay.
We have verification of that location, which we see in image, and I'll see if I can pull it up here, yes, 25. Image 25 shows over the right shoulder of the videographer the northeast edge of the Molokai mountain range, cliff range, on the north side. And that comports precisely with what the pilot said, one of the few things that did comport with it, that is he was rounding the turn for Honolulu. And he claims at that point to have been at 300 feet. However, we have quite a lot of proof showing that he was at or above 1,000 feet. So instead of being at 300 feet, he was in the range of 1,000 feet. Actually, there are two reports from passengers which use the identical words and say the aircraft was between 1,000 and 1,500 feet. So there's internal
passenger... And this is an important point because... This is an important point, folks, because... If he was at a much higher altitude, he could easily have made a return, a glide back to the runway and didn't have to ditch in the water. His location when this supposed engine failure happened is an essential part of the story. The reality is there was no need to ditch in the ocean as occurred, and it goes back to this controlled water landing that actually occurred. And let me just add this, why this particular pilot? There's real questions, valid questions, about who this individual actually is from an experience level. He, amongst other things in his repertoire, flew an aircraft for air races. This is a guy that wasn't just a average commercial pilot doing this this, or even a low-hour commuter airline pilot with his hours, his age, his expertise level, it would be probably very unusual to be at this backwater airline flying this type of aircraft, given his history. But mm-hmm. the reality is he was the guy because he had a he had the skill sets to fly and do this unusual water landing, put it on the numbers, and get it down intact safely, if you will, to concoct this ruse.
So the location, the location of where he landed was significant then? I mean, there was a reason for him to land at that particular
absolutely.
Point?
Yes, yes.
And let me just add that this was the director of operations for a small, successful airline with many pilots they had working for them. And he's taking this run, which to Kalaupapa and back should have been normally done by a $15 an hour kind of pilot. And yet this is the director of operations doing this one. So that's pretty unusual. But if we go back to image 32 and look at that, the top-down view, we see in blue the line that would indicate if you've lost your engine and you're having to glide down to the ocean, where you would take it. Now, we know at that altitude that he had that he should have easily been able to make it to the runway. In fact, there's a tailwind at that point, giving him 15 knots of push, which should have made it not only possible, but easily to the runway.
Huh.
And we can see that. Now, there's a marking there. It shows the D. We know that is where the aircraft indeed ditched. So why would the pilot accept a tailwind of 15 knots to land at that particular place? Now, normally a pilot will put down his aircraft only into the wind, and indeed trading off 30 knots worth of wind, that is, instead of having 15 knots of tailwind, you have 15 knots of headwind, that would slow your aircraft down so that whatever you hit when you touch down is going to come at you 30 knots slower than otherwise.
Right, right.
So that's tremendously important. There's not a pilot over 500 hours who would ever do this kind of maneuver. And yet we're to believe that's what he did, that he had a catastrophic failure at X, and this 18,000-hour pilot puts his aircraft down, supposedly downwind at that location. Well, no.
So the blue fact, the blue line, just to clarify, the blue line then shows what he told the NTSB and the FAA, that he just basically allowed the wind to push him and followed that path to point D where he ditched, rather than what the evidence suggests he did, which is follow the red line and then circle back around the yellow path. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. That is, he supposedly had no power and was unable to make the field, were his two claims.
Right.
But he did have that. And it implies, we know that the blue line arrowed, whatever, was not what he took, but that's what his story does imply.
Okay.
Now, we know that that D is where he landed, but the yellow arc that has out on the water and coming into that D is what he actually did. But that also implies these two facts, that he was starting at, we'll say, 1,000 feet, and he, the second portion of the video starts at about 255 feet. So he's moved about three-quarter mile and lost about 750 feet in altitude.
Hmm.
But in doing so, he's turning away from the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's just no way in the world that that should be what a person would do. You would want to make the airport so you'd have a safe landing for all of your paying customers. But he goes out, and we are told that it's just a few seconds that the videographer had his video off. But we know that's not true. It must have been at least the greater part, the majority of a minute, if not much longer. It's quite possible it might have been several minutes. But anyway, nonetheless, he picks up his the videographer picks up the second portion of the video at that point, within some number of yards. It's not precise, but it's relatively correct. We know that they were in a gentle left bank the entire way, and we know that the aircraft was pointed into the sun, which was probably a marker that he had practiced. That is, if we look at, let's see which image that is. Oh, yes, image 27. That's the first, in the first second of video for the second portion. We see in the right image the sun's rays coming in just on the edge of that window. That means, if you follow where the sun is going, mm-hmm. as you can see on the overhead map on the left, that he's headed into the sun at that point, which is very different from where he left at the red X, where the sun's rays were literally coming in at a roughly 90-degree angle
right.
to the airplane. So we know that takes a number of seconds. And with the other features of height and distance where that video starts, we know that he's repositioned the aircraft with respect to the sun, with respect to altitude and orientation. So he's lied about all of that. The videographer has lied about that. And we see that arc out from the water and landing very near the shore there. We've measured that. We have Google can help us measure things like that. We have imagery. If we look at image 87, we see from the water's point of view, out over the water where that aircraft came to rest, and it's rather close to the shoreline. In fact, we've measured it, for example, with not only Google Maps, but also with replications of the wingspan of that aircraft, and that can be seen in image 144, and it shows that it has its 13.5 wingspans from shore,
mm-hmm.
and that translates to 702 feet or 234 yards. And the upper left map in 144 shows you the bathymetry map that was included in the NTSB report. And right near where the plane came down, there's an area marked on that map as being only 1 meter deep.
Oh, okay.
And there's another area just to the south of that that shows outcroppings of the ocean floor,
mm-hmm.
also very close to that area. Now, that image on the right of that 144 image shows you the satellite view from top down on a different day, mind you, but it shows these little eddies and currents that surround the area where the ocean floor literally comes up out of the water at that point. So this is a very shallow area, and even though the constant depth line on the bathymetry map upper left shows 4.25 at that line, which would translate to roughly 18 feet or so, 17 feet,
mm-hmm.
That tells you that this is a shallow area, and we have images throughout that show and suggest that the people are able to stand. If we look momentarily here let's see, number 97, for example, image 97 with life jackets,
mm-hmm.
we see at the lower right, one of the passengers' life jacket isn't touching the water at all.
Right.
Similarly, in the upper middle picture, he's not touching the water at all. If we look at the image labeled Poseidon, you see that the guy is apparently standing. He's got
no life jacket at all.
Half of his body, foot and a half of his body out of water there. If we look at the image of 99, we see the assistant to Loretta Fuddy in the middle of that image, and his life jacket is barely touching the water, and his shoulders are clearly out of the water. Now, we have other images of him when he's clearly resting on that life jacket, and it's just as you would expect. Even in the lower portion of that image, it's Well, that's not a good example because there, too, he's out of the water. But let me see if I've got one where they're literally resting on the water. Well, anyway, for the moment, trust me, you'll see the life jacket is fully in contact with the water. So it's a clear difference that anyone could note.
Mm-hmm.
So those things were going on, and we see the airplane actually tipped. If we look at image 57 for a moment, you can see that the airplane, as it came to rest, was tipped from the left wing. The port wing was up out of the water, not touching, and probably as high as 10 feet on the far side.
Mm-hmm.
And the lower wing is to the right, the starboard wing, and you can see that in the larger image at right, where the right wing is down.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the upper left image, you'll see that the windows on the right side of the airplane are lower than the window on the far side of the airplane.
Right,
so
right.
That's a further indication of this tipping. Again, then the guy behind or underneath the tail without a life jacket,
mm-hmm.
Doing just fine without having to thrash and swim and so forth. He's just literally standing there.
Mm-hmm.
So let me jump in here,
and the point here, the point here is that the aircraft was ditched in water so shallow that the landing gear is on the bottom. It's impacted into the floor, deflected the floor, actually caused the only real injury on the aircraft from the water landing, which was a passenger whose seat was pushed up into the from the floor up and caused an injury. This plane didn't land as they initially tried to fool us in some of the roughest water on the planet, you know, 1,000 feet of water, et cetera. They tried to initially say that the aircraft would be unrecoverable because it was, you know, in this horrible, horrendous, high current, heavy wave action water. The reality is, they landed in water that you and I would go out and bounce around in and relax if we were going off the beach to enjoy a day in Hawaii in the sun.
Yeah.
And this was, you know, bath water. They could easily have gotten to shore. A baby swimmer could have got to shore from this location. This exact ditching location was picked for a reason, because they wanted to concoct a story, and they had this videographer prepped and ready to go to document it. You know, it was a month after the crash before he even disclosed that he had video.
Oh.
All this time after the crash, we're never going to know what's happened suddenly out of the blue, because people are questioning what's going on here. To cement the story, then miraculously he shows up with the video.
With pieces missing, yeah.
This was orchestration. And the reason that let me just jump in here, because, you know, just like we did, you know, over 5 hours with John Wells, we could bog down on the minutiae, but I think we have to kind of catapult forward through a lot of this. The reality is it's a manufactured event. With a skilled pilot, the guy shooting the video is a free diver that's, you know, goes down, you know, hundreds of feet, if you will, on just a breath of air in competitions.
Hmm.
Other people on the airplane each have certain skill sets. In fact, we even see what appears to be a dummy in the aircraft to simulate stuff. One of the passengers clearly has a jacket that can be inflated into a life vest, and he's wearing it as though it's just casual clothing on the plane, because he's guaranteeing he's not going to expire in this theatrical event. Further on in this event, we see divers in the water in this video that clearly could not have been people from the airplane. We mm-hmm. see extra people in the water, and we even see a vehicle, which is a SEAL team type vehicle, clearly in the video in just a handful of frames, that accidentally got in there that didn't get edited out.
A SEAL team type vehicle. What sort of vehicle are you talking about?
a driver transportation vehicle, which is an underwater sled, if you will, mm-hmm. to move personnel covertly. And this type of a vehicle is deployed from a submarine that can either have a wet or a dry enclosure mounted to it. And just so happens that conveniently the one sub in the area that has that capability to deploy a diver transportation vehicle, an underwater sled, if you will, just so happens to be a couple miles offshore as this event is happening. And we have that in records from the Navy proving that that vehicle was there. This isn't just an educated guess or, you know, we're out in conspiracy, you know, Lulu land. So,
and we see lots of other...
Yes, lots of other things. Well, and so let me just put it this way. In fact, if you could pull up the picture of the fish, for me personally, the one piece of evidence beyond the diver transportation vehicle, which lost left neutral buoyancy and became visible in a few frames of the video, mm-hmm. Beside the aircraft, this electronic fish, which is the communication
132,
is there in the video. That's not natural. That's not Photoshopped. That's nothing. That's in the video. The NTSB has the video that was broadcast on the evening news there. That's in the video. That is not natural. That is not something that came off the plane. That is a very sophisticated, but coyly disguised communications device, sort of, you know, mimicking a fish, but it's obviously man-made. Why is that there?
Because we believe it would have been part of an underwater network.
A communication
network.
That would have been. And in fact, we see several things in these photographs, in these video extracts, that are part of an underwater communications system so that the divers can communicate as they're pulling off this, you know, visual fraud. And in fact, what's directly overhead as this is going on? A communications aircraft. A relay, if you will, for those people that would have been watching this. So a manufactured event, highly choreographed, with military assets and very possibly military personnel, or at the very least contractors utilizing those military assets, is present in this video. And why was this video released to the public? They were trying to convince us, because a lot of people in the public, in the not mainstream media, were questioning the convenience of Loretta Fuddy being the sole death in this plane crash. So this was supposed to cement for us that, you know, nothing here, move along, it's all exactly as we said, and how could you, you know, possibly question this when here's the video of the horrible event as it happened and these people in a desperate life and death struggle. It's Hollywood. And in fact, even the other aircraft who are calling in and communicating about this, who are they? They're Hollywood people. Tell them about that, Hugo. I mean, this is a Hollywood event intended to propagandize us into believing this fraud.
Coincidentally, the owner of the airline and the first on the scene pilot, who ostensibly had no connection to one another but actually did very much, were both involved with two different television series and flying helicopters for those series. One was Lost, and the other was Hawaii 5-0. They were both working together. They both flew in that particular airline's helicopters.
Uh-huh.
So even though this pilot supposedly comes out of his nowhere with a girlfriend beside him, he's actually a friend of the airline owner who's flown in that particular airline's helicopters for years. So where they have the cover of coincidence, supposedly, no, it's all planned, and obviously they would have had to know ahead of time. And what that random first on the scene pilot is able to read into the record, of course, just comports with the desired official narrative, but actually is not in many ways.
Let me just jump forward, because we could get bogged down in a lot of this, but let me just jump forward and say this also. The entire event is staged. Once you have looked at the evidence, that's incontrovertible, I think, for any reasonable person, even at the outer fringes where you're highly doubting that somebody would want to do this or could do this or pull it off. I think a reasonable person looks at it and goes, oh, my gosh, it is clearly fraudulent. This is a staged event. But what are the implications of that?
Right.
Because remember, who all had to agree to stay in there with this lie? You have NTSB.
Mm-hmm.
People at the NTSB who, in looking at this, easily could see that the evidence was falsified or not jiving. They look the other way, and in fact, they add to the falsification, because one of the key events here, why were these divers in the water, what were they doing? When the plane was later recovered, the engine was detached from the airframe, and they attributed this to a storm that had happened in those few days. Initially, they weren't going to recover this, supposedly, but then suddenly they decided they're going to recover it. So they find this engine and the airframe separate. Let me just tell you, because I have involvement in high-speed vehicles and aircraft, the strongest area of the airplane is where the engine attaches to the frame.
You'd hope so.
Those components are designed to stretch, to twist, to do all sorts of things, but not to detach. The amount of force required to detach an engine from an airframe, you'd have to hit a telephone pole sideways at 500 knots. And it'd have to be, able to slice and dice. That'd take more than a telephone pole to do it, probably. But at the end of the day, that's the strongest part of the aircraft, and yet it's detached from the aircraft. What did we find when we start looking at this? First of all, the divers are there using what appears to be cutting equipment, underwater demolition equipment, cutting that engine off the aircraft. Why? Because the engine is the evidence. When the plane went in the water, certain things would happen internally to the engine if it was running. If the engine wasn't running when it hit the water, then it would have different types of evidence.
Sure.
So when they decided to recover the aircraft and the engine separate from the airframe, the people on the barge, and this is something that Corsi had somebody that was apparently a witness to this, they picked up two engines, is what it appears. And that would make sense based on what we're seeing.
On a single engine plane.
Two engines? It's a one engine airplane.
Yeah. And I noticed in one of the photos.
There were multiple engines
there, but I think it's necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because
so Hugo, let me just say this. Go ahead and tell them, Hugo, just so they get a few of these images in there. How do we know that engine was cut away? That it had to be cut manually, not as a result of the crash. That's part of the most important evidence in this case, because the NTSB tried to obscure the photographs that clearly show very powerful machine. Cuts were made to the areas where the engine would connect. You know, there's hoses, there's metal pipes, coolant lines, etc., that you couldn't just go there with a hacksaw and easily cut. These are very hard to cut types of components, they are cut with very complex pieces of equipment. There is zero reason why on that barge the engine should look the way that it is, or engines, and that can only come because somebody was trying to conceal evidence and provide evidence that wasn't correct. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Eric, you'll want to bring up image 128, probably a good bit earlier in the conversation, as W was describing it, so they'll get a chance to look at that image there. But we also see that the NTSB has falsified their report, literally showing evidence that was altered, which is just an incredible thing to have to say. If we look at, let me see which image that is. Well, we'll get one that's close to that. That is image 127. It shows the two different engines. One is still under the water, and one is the one that was pulled up on the barge. The one on the barge has three propeller blades that are still in the propeller disc plane. That is, they're turning around in the same plane as they would when they're turning normally or powering the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But in the underwater aircraft, the one that ditched, the propeller was feathered, and we can see that because the lowest propeller blade was bent back severely to contact, literally, or very close to, if not exactly, that nose gear strut that comes down below. So that one blade, because it was the first to hit, and it was the airplane, the propeller was not turning, it got bent back the most, while that upper blade shows almost no bending, at least as we can see from the image. So that shows the propeller blades were differentially bent in this event, mm-hmm. showing that the prop was not turning. But if you look at the engine on the left, you say, which of those blades is that lowest blade from the right picture?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it can't be any of them.
None of them, right.
Because it does. A propeller is so beefy, and there's just no rolling around on the rocks that would ever bend it back so that it could possibly be any of those that are shown on the left. So that's a big part of the problem here. If we look at image 129, we see two things. It's not the best picture for the back of the engine, but at the upper left is the back of the engine. It's the only picture in the whole series that has the back of the engine, and it's fuzzed up. It's literally been photoshopped, and I'll get you the better image for your post-production
right.
dropping in. But in the lower, in the upper left there, there's a rectangular box around the a propeller paint on one of the blades.
Mm-hmm.
We call that the blade tip paint pattern. And you can see that's the only blade tip paint in that we see in the, but actually that's been falsified, and we could go at length to exactly explain why, but the long and the short is those other two images, the larger images at right and below, are other pictures of that very same propeller blade, and it shows the original paint pattern of those, and it's very different, which show that the NTSB or someone working in conjunction with the NTSB has literally falsified that piece of evidence. So why they would do so is because it would more closely match the underwater images we have of the blades on that particular plane, the one that ditched.
Mm-hmm.
And an image that would show that, let me see if I can find it for you. Yeah, image 42 shows the difference between the images of the engine blade that was brought up on the barge and the images of the engine or the propeller blades from underwater. And those show a wider black area between the two white stripes for the barge image than the ones that came from underwater. And it tells us confirmingly that there were two different engines because there was, those were two different propellers.
Hmm.
So we have at least three different ways that there are differences that show there's two engines, and we have the NTSB literally falsifying the evidence or letting the evidence be falsified so that we're made to believe that they were the same propeller blade paint when they weren't, because I, in fact, had a conversation with the investigator in charge, and I apprised him that this proved that there were two engines, so I think that was probably the motivation that brought them to do that. And whoever it was, we went over earlier that falsification of the silent 6 seconds at the beginning of the recording, or the second portion after the supposed catastrophic engine failure. That is another falsification of the data, whoever did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to comport with the evidence that actually three different witnesses told the Maui police. They all used exactly the same wording, what a coincidence, to say everything went quiet. That was a phrase in all of their testimony. All of the people who spoke to the police use that very same phrase. And if the evidence would suggest that it didn't ever go quiet, maybe that would be a problem.
Yeah.
So I think that might have been a motivation for them making that change. So we have three different ways very clearly that the evidence has been falsified. So not only do they come to false conclusions, and that's really why I went into some of that, all of this detail that W talked about, that is, to show that it's not just us waving hands and saying, oh, this is a conspiracy or something like that. No, there's literally detail after detail after detail after detail that the NTSB cannot seemingly get right. And these are people who are the cream of the crop. They do not make these kind of mistakes.
Hmm.
And if you look at image 108, for example, you see the last image before touching down on the water, and it has the plane in a left bank. It has the nose low. It has this airplane in a situation that no pilot would ever knowingly do. And that had to be for an unusual reason, which I can only throw my head at. But the proof is in the image there. They touched down the water in a way that the NTSB says was completely different. The NTSB's writing says it landed wings level onto the water, and slightly nose-up attitude, if not flat. Here it is. It says, landed within open ocean water in a flat or nose-up attitude. Well, they had this image right before them. They could have seen that. This is false. It wasn't the open ocean. It wasn't flat. It was nose down. They said it was slightly nose-up attitude. All of these things are false, and any person can look at the evidence and see otherwise. So why would they have put false statements in their report? And it had to comport with...
Well, let me jump in here. The import here is this. In our observation, it's readily, easily provable that the NTSB's report is falsified and is concocted in many ways with photoshopping, etc. We wouldn't be having this conversation if we didn't have the video and the stills that we've extracted from the video. Somewhere in here, somebody thought they were doing a Hollywood production and they needed to have this as a backup, and they played this card. Had we not had the video, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, because we would have to accept the statements of the various people at face value. I think that the players involved overreached in trying to prove their story and to quiet down any potential critics. And when they overplayed their hand, they gave us tools, material that can prove the fraud of this crash in ways that maybe other events we can speculate at, but we just don't have enough stuff to work with to prove otherwise. In this case, we do. It's, you know, out there. It's not going away. It's in the history books. They've revealed their hand too much. Now, why is that important for us now?
Right, right. That's the key question.
What was the point in doing this whole thing? Listen, what kind of power does it take to get the National Transportation Board, experts, professionals, guys with a career, guys with a reputation, who want to preserve their reputation by doing great work, and that others could look at their work and critique and say, hey, that doesn't work. That's BS, like we're doing right now. What's it take to cause guys to do something false like this? Where does the power come from, and how great is the power to cause investigators like this to provide a lying report? And not just the NTSB. This also occurred at the local level with the police department and the fire department there at Maui County. This occurred with state officials. This occurred with FAA officials. These people have all participated in a knowing lie. And who can pull the strings that broadly and deeply? What is the level of, I'll just say it, corruption going on here? This is unacceptable in our society. And if this type of corruption can stand, then we cannot have honest elections and a honest chance for the citizenry to supervise their government, because right. We are being lied to using government assets to manufacture and then perpetrate a lie in order to cause us to make certain decisions, take certain actions that support one particular group. And it goes to the integrity of our government, of we the people. We are being propagandized using our own federal agencies. How can individual citizens hope to control their government when the whole weight and power of the federal machine is engineering falsehoods against the people, perpetrating these lies to get you to act certain ways, accept certain things, vote a certain way? Because this was about maintaining the outcome of a vote and maintaining the perspective of the people about this person who was kept in office as a result of this whole birth certificate thing, etc. Clint Eastwood said it, I thought, very well. He said, you know, when the history books are written, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but when the history books are written, the American people will realize that this was the most fraudulent presidency ever perpetrated on the American people, that this entire presidency is just one big fraud from one end to the other.
Let me ask you this, and we just have a few minutes left because I'm under some time constraints today as far as how much longer we can go here, say, with just a few minutes left. And I will, in the show notes, for the benefit of listeners and viewers who want to go deeper into this, link to the interviews done previously by Hugo Fugan with Joe and Doug Hagman and John B. Wells, so that you can take advantage of what they've already done. Rather than waiting for us to do another interview, and hopefully we can do this again. But just to get your sense, Hugo and the W, what is the net effect here? I mean, where are we now in America as a result of the FUDI crash? I mean, I guess by that, I mean, has the Donald Trump presidency, how has that affected what the elites behind engineering the fraud of the FUDI crash.
Looking at a snapshot in time 3 years ago where this was the case, but even though Donald Trump may be president, we don't believe that the people who pulled the strings for this have any less power, really, than they did at this time.
Right,
there's
right.
No investigation by the FBI, so there's no reason to understand that that's been changed. That needs to be done. We need an honest investigation. What the NTSB has done needs to be put aside, and it needs to be reinvestigated. The people who were corruptly plying their hand in this need to be asked the questions so that we find the person who gave the order for these kinds of things. All that needs to be done before these things can be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just add one.
Let me jump in here. My concern is this. You know, we have an alleged death. There is no statute of limitations
right.
on murder. if this was a staged event and she did in fact die, she died as a result of this theater that they were doing. We don't believe she died at all.
Okay, that was the question I was going to ask, because you'd used the phrase alleged death earlier on, and I realized I had let that thread kind of hang out there. So I'm glad you're addressing this now, W. So if then is she complicit in all of this? Again, what does this mean for the country in which we live?
Well, again, you know, here we can say, as far as I'm concerned, conclusively, that this was a manufactured event in order to perpetrate a fraudulent scenario onto mm-hmm. the American public and the world, really, in order to maintain a specific individual in his office, which is Barack Obama, as the president of the United States, without him having his authority questioned or undermined based on, you know, this person, the birth certificate, et cetera, or even the alleged crash. And so we were, this was to maintain a political situation where they could work with impunity, continuing on probably with their Mideast operations to go after Syria and take out Assad. But if that's the case, and all of these federal assets are used, those people aren't elected to office,
right,
for the most part. The correct body to investigate a death in this type of situation is actually the FBI. If this was a fraudulent event, which we say it is, without any reservation, then the FBI should be investigating. The NTSB should be handing the material over to the FBI to do a criminal investigation of what transpired here. With that in mind, they're very politicized over there also. And so the question is, can we get to honest investigations? And with these players that transcend administrations of Democrat or Republican, that is the deep state that we're talking about. These people down through the ranks that were involved in maintaining this fraud against the American people are still there. That's a threat to this current administration. That is a threat to President Trump, who was one of the people trying to question or bring out into the public conversation this whole birth certificate matter. So this is a threat because this is war at the deep state level.
Yeah.
And I say war very precisely, not just in a trivial sense, because military assets were in play in this event
mm-hmm.
in order to perpetrate the propaganda, the fraud of this being a legitimate airplane crash with the death of this individual.
Mm.
If you have military assets, militarized propaganda against the American people, that is something that we cannot allow to stand. And I will add, by the way, there is a component of this that goes back to Extortion 17 and the death of those SEALs in that event.
Oh, yeah.
Who had knowledge of what actually occurred in this alleged death of bin Laden in that event in Pakistan.
Abbottabad, yeah.
So both of these actually work together because, again, the SEAL team assets were in play and military assets were in play in all of these events, and we believe, in fact, in a real investigation that we will find persons involved in the military who were complicit in orchestrating both events for the same purpose, keeping this person, Barack Obama, in office, in these concocted, staged events to protect the narrative.
Hmm.
can't be allowed to stand. We need honest investigations, and that's where President Trump could allow these investigations request, and Congress also could demand that these cases be reopened. A simple reopening of the NTSB's investigation, followed up by FBI investigation where appropriate for the criminal aspects, both of the cover-up inside the NTSB. There is an FBI need authority, legal authority need to investigate the goings-on at NTSB for criminal activity in the NTSB in providing, fabricating, changing evidence, both of a fraudulent nature and creating fraudulent evidence, the photoshopping that was done of these photos to obscure what really occurred in this event. This is criminal activity. This isn't just politics and, well, they said this and, well, somebody's – this is criminal activity. A death is involved, and it was all about maintaining a person in office where there's now a question that's a legitimate question. If they're going to this level, number one, how deep is the deep state?
Right.
And how much do we actually have control of our government when we're being lied to with – assets in this kind of a magnitude.
Yeah. This was
Let me just add three small things. Okay. Really quick. There's other coercive things involved here that have only been tangentially mentioned. One is the financial aspects, that is scores of millions of dollars changed hands in all of this. And it's just immense. And the retribution that's been involved, there has been threats, there have been actions that have actually been taken that have hurt people. And thirdly, these Navy SEALs, for example, the secrecy aspect, that is, these are people who were used opportunistically because they are all under sworn secrecy, that they cannot talk about any of the operations they've been on. And to get to the bottom of this, we need to be able to let them talk on some of these things.
Yeah. Well, this is why we at Skywatch TV have been saying,
or at a presidential level, there has to be some type of place, opportunity, where these people can speak to what actually occurred without any threat or without any potential to violate their oaths. And I believe that in an honest investigation, these people have a lot that they would like to say, but they can't, because they're under within a certain command structure that they literally go to jail if they did speak.
Yeah.
So they're essentially have been put in this catch-22 situation as fellow citizens, where there hasn't been a opportunity, an avenue, a mechanism where they can provide the information that's needed that they have in order to get to the truth of what actually occurred here. FBI investigations with proper authorities and congressional oversight of investigations, even a demand from Trump for these investigations to occur, would provide a mechanism where these people can provide their information free from any duress or threat, because they have somehow violated a secrecy oath that they're under.
Yeah. And this is why we at Skywatch TV, where I spend my weekdays, have been saying for quite some time now that we, as Christian Americans, American Christians, need to pray for our president and pray for those around him, because certainly if such an investigation were to be launched, I mean, just one of many reasons why we say we need to pray for him. But if such an investigation were to be launched, certainly the deep state would not go down without a fight. And as we can see from the evidence, and knowing that we've only scratched the surface of what's in the book, The Fuddy Hoax, they don't fight fair. So this is something that we are appreciative of the work that you've done. And again, I will link in the show notes either at VFTB.net, well, both at VFTB.net. And if you're watching this on video at YouTube, look in the description below, because I will have links to the previous interviews that Hugo Fugin has done on this particular topic. The book is The Fuddy Hoax. You can get it in hardback and also as a PDF download, which contains links to multimedia files many of which we have discussed during the previous hour or so. And you'll find that at the website, thefuddyhoax.com. Again, I know we've only scratched the surface here, but I am under some time constraints today.
Let me just add 30 seconds here. One thing that is critically important, and why is this relevant now? This happened years ago. Listen, folks, this person who was kept in office through fraud, through this criminal activity, is still active and trying to influence the direction of the country, and the people behind him who put him there are still in play.
Right.
The legitimacy of his presidency and his legitimacy to be in this conversation at this time within our national system, within the international politics, if this is a staged event, if this was a propaganda, militarized propaganda thing against the American people, his specific legitimacy to be in the national conversation right now is null and void.
That's right.
And he shouldn't be listened to, and those people supporting him in this shouldn't be listened to. He should not be on the national stage. He should be potentially involved in some type of criminal indictment if he authorized or had any participation or knowingly allowed this fraud to occur to keep him in the presidency. Mm.
Well, whether he did or he didn't, the fact that this was used to keep him in power by persons unknown should delegitimize his presidency and whatever influence he still wields today with his alternative White House.
That's the key point.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the key? What is his legitimacy to be in the conversation right now?
Right.
This fraud being what it is, he should not be part of our national conversation because of those frauds. This event specifically establishes that point. That's why we're raising it now. That's why it's still relevant now. This is the one that's developed enough to allow for actual legal action, congressional, FBI investigations, et cetera, to get to the bottom of what occurred here, who was involved, what did they know, when did they know it, what was their personal involvement in perpetrating this fraud.
Amen. W, thank you for your input.
And who's still left.
And who's still left, yes. Well, we again, this is a conversation we've been having at Skywatch TV for the last month. God bless men like Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, who's still inside the Pentagon as a consultant and seeing some of the things that goes on there. I'm sure he knows things that he can't tell us about, but he has hinted at things that are quite dark. And this is the physical manifestation of some of that darkness. The Death of Loretta Fuddy, the book The Fuddy Hoax, co-authors Nellie Ristvet and Hugo Fugan, who's been our guest along with W. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time today, and perhaps we can do this again and dig into some more depth.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, I know we only scratched the surface, even in a 90-minute program, we barely scratched the surface of the evidence that Hugo and his associate have put together on the Loretta Fuddy crash. It is clearly evident from just what we presented in this program today that the official story is not what happened on December 11th of 2013. I encourage you to get the book, to check out the earlier interviews, which, again, I will link to in the show notes below this video, or if you're listening to this as a podcast, check out the show notes at vftb.net. And I'll put links there to the interviews that Hugo has done over the past year with Joe and Doug Hagman, with John B. Wells, and others. They've got a number of them linked at the website, thefuddyhoax.com, under the media tab of the website there. But again, I will link to that in the show notes as well. What really did happen? And what is the aftermath? Is Loretta Fuddy still alive somewhere? That is entirely possible. But again, once you start by dismantling the official story, then the next question is, why was a story concocted about this particular event, and who benefits? Qui bene? Who stands to gain from putting forward the false story about the crash of this plane in 2013? And again, why is it still relevant today? Well, of course, the deeper state and the work, the books that we've been talking about on Skywatch TV over the last month have a lot to say about that. The Deeper State by Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, Saboteurs by Tom Horn, And then Gods and Thrones by Pastor Carl Gallups, which looks at the spiritual source behind all of this. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against rulers of this present darkness, against spiritual wickedness in high places. It's the Apostle Paul, and presumably he knew what he was writing about. Coming up next weekend, next Sunday, November 19th, we will talk to Doug Woodward. Haven't had him back on the program for a while. And a new friend, Gary Huffman. Had the opportunity to meet Gary at the conference, the Hear the Watchman conference in Boise, Idaho. This is their book, The Revealing, Unlocking Hidden Truths on the Glorification of God's Children. We'll get into the theology here and see what revelations they have for us in the book, The Revealing. See the play on words I did there. That will be next Sunday, the 19th, on A View from the Bunker. We'll probably take the week after that as a holiday week, that being the week of Thanksgiving. I myself working on a new manuscript, trying to get a new book together and out. I've got two outlined and ideas for more, but one thing at a time. So right now working on a book based on the presentation that I've given at Oklahoma City and in Boise, or in Branson, rather, this year. So that is next up on my plate. The speaking of the conference in Oklahoma City, or Norman, Oklahoma, actually, the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum, the DVD sets are available and will be shipping in January. So if you weren't able to attend and didn't take advantage of the live stream, or if you just want a hard copy that you can play at your leisure and share with friends, you can get those through our friends at Prophecy Watchers. Sign up, get those at prophecywatchers.com. Every speaker, every presentation, so basically about 65, 66 presentations over the course of the weekend from the speakers there, including Tom Horn, L.A. Marzulli, Dr. Tommy Ice, Bill Salas, Rabbi Jonathan Kahn, me, Sharon Josh Peck, Dr. Michael Lake, Tim Alberino, many others on that. And again, you'll find more information at prophecywatchers.com. Hear the Watchman, another conference coming to Dallas. This will be March 22nd through the 25th of 2018. You can register now and get an early bird discount, if you will. Bill Salas will be joining the lineup at Hear the Watchman. Rabbi Zev Parat coming back from Tel Aviv. We look forward to seeing him and his wife Lynn again. Pastor Paul Begley, Pastor Carl Gallups again. L.A. Marzulli, Dr. Michael Lake, Mark Taylor, co-author of The Trump Prophecies, will be there. Josh Tolley, me, Sharon, Josh Peck, Pastor Casper McLeod, and more. For information and registration, hearthewatchmen.com. That's hearthewatchmen.com. Please, if you get a moment, give us a review. Appreciate that at the VFTB page at iTunes or on Stitcher, wherever else you find us, which, of course, is wherever fine podcasts are sold. And you can give us a like at Facebook, follow up, and make comments on the programs there at the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/viewfromthebunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives, 4.0 international license. The opening theme is by Kevin McLeod. His website is incompetech.com. The opening announcer is D.C. Good. As before, remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.